Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City or in Ireland or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America and the global Irish since our founding in 1993. We are coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you got over St. Patrick's Day well, and if you marked the occasion that you had a good time and you saluted the person of March who we all remember in St. Patrick. There were, it seems, successful parades and celebrations all over the world, and I have to say, as an Irish person living in the diaspora, it is very inspiring to see how this little island in the North Atlantic inspires so much celebration and green on the big day, and fair play to whoever was involved in making sure that many of the buildings and cultural centres of the world, some of the most iconic places, were lit up in green on Tuesday. It was a fantastic thing to see and something that we should not take for granted, because not every country's national holiday is celebrated with such gusto. Here at Glucksman Ireland House, we're currently on spring break, so the place is nice and quiet. Ironically, one of the centres of Irish ness here at New York is rather quiet this time of year because our spring break always coincides with St. Patrick's Day. I don't think the university administrators were necessarily thinking about our national holiday, but it is nice that we don't have classes this week. And as I say, it is rather quiet here. We're currently reviewing applications for the Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies here at Glucksman Ireland House NYU. We are still accepting applications, so if you are interested in that program, do reach out any time. You can speak to me, Dr. Miriam Nighan, or my colleague, Professor John Waters, who directs the program. We'd be delighted to tell you more a little bit about the program. It encompasses history, literature, culture, music, among other disciplines, and is a really fantastic inter- and transdisciplinary program. On this week's programme, I'm delighted to let you know that Mick Maloney, my colleague here at Glucksman Ireland House NYU, who is also a professor in the Department of Music, a world-renowned performer and ethnomusicologist, and indeed a great raconteur, Mick is popping in to have a chat to me about his upcoming reunion concert, Mick Maloney, Jimmy Keane and Robbie O'Connell, which will take place March 27th and 28th at 8 p.m. at the Irish Arts Centre. These three Irish music legends will make a triumphant return to New York City. They've been playing together since the mid-1980s. You'll hear Mick talking a little bit about this. Each one of them is regarded as the best in his field. The combination of them brings a great depth and range to their concerts. Mick Maloney has recorded or produced over 40 albums of traditional music and has formed two of the great bands of this generation, the Greenfields of America and Cherish the Lady. Many regard Keane as the premier exponent of traditional Irish music on the piano accordion. He was honoured as the male musician of the decade by Live Ireland and the Irish American News. O'Connell is an Irish singer and songwriter born in Waterford. He's a nephew of one of the Clancys, and he began touring with them in 1977 and with Eileen Ivers and Seamus Egan in the Greenfields of America. So Mick's going to have a chat to us about what's in store. Fantastic concerts. I'm sure they're going to be sold out soon. So get on to the Irish Arts Site website as soon as you can, folks, or give them a call if you're interested in attending that and take a listen to what Mick has to say. I'm also delighted to say that a visiting scholar, a postdoctoral researcher who's been here at NYU over the last couple of months is taking some time out of his schedule to have a chat to me about his research. I'm talking about Dr. Patrick Doyle, who's here by way of the University of Manchester. And Patrick grew up in England, the son of Irish immigrants, and he is here undertaking some really interesting research on the Irish cooperative movement. Any of you who are familiar with Irish history or community or Irish society over the last 100 years or so will know the role of the cooperative movement, I suppose most tangibly seen through the local creameries for people in rural Ireland. Patrick's doctoral research was initially on the co-ops, and he was over here expanding on the role of Horace Plunkett, who was a real pioneer of the Irish cooperative movement and who had strong ties with the United States. So I'm delighted to say that Patrick is going to come in and have a chat to me about his research, about being of Irish descent in Britain, and about Horace Plunkett and his connections with the United States. It's really, really very fascinating, folks, and I hope you enjoy. I'm going to start off, kick things off a little bit by playing one of Mick Maloney's tunes. I should say one of Mick Maloney's, Jimmy Keane's and Robbie O'Connell's tunes. And this is a song called Kilkelly, and this will give you a taste for what's in store next weekend, folks. So sit back for the next 6 minutes or so and enjoy this song before we come in to have a chat with Mick.
Kilkelly, Ireland, 1860, my dear and loving son John. Your good friend, schoolmaster Pat McNamara, so good as to write these words down. Your brothers have all gone to find work in England, the house is so empty and sad. Crop of potatoes is sorely infected, a third to a half of them bad. And your sister Bridget and Patrick O'Donnell are going to be married in June. Your mother says not to work on the railroad, and be sure to come on home soon. Kilkelly, Ireland, 1870, my dear and loving son John. Hello to your missus and to your four children, may they grow healthy and strong. Michael's got in a wee bit of trouble, I suppose that he never will learn. Because of the dampness, there's no turf to speak of, and now we have nothing to burn. Bridget is happy, you named a child for her, although she's got sticks of her own. You say you found work, but you don't say what kind, or when you'll be coming home. Sorry to give you the very sad news that your dear old mother has gone. We buried her down at the church in Kilkelly. Your brothers and Bridget were there. Don't have to worry, she died very quickly. Remember her in your prayers. And it's so good to hear
that Michael's returning with money he's sure to buy land. For the crop has been poor and the people are selling at any price that they can. I suppose that I must be close on 80. It's 30 years since you've gone. Because of all of the money you sent me, I'm still living out of my own. Michael has built himself a fine house, and Bridget's daughters are grown. And thank you for sending your family picture. They're lovely young women and men. You say that you might even come for a visit. What joy to see you again. Ireland 1892, my dear brother John, I'm sorry I didn't write sooner to tell you that father passed on. He was living with Bridget, she said he was cheerful and healthy right down to the end. You should have seen him playing with the grandchildren at Max McMahon, your friend. And we buried him alongside of Mother down at the Kilkelly churchyard. He was a strong and a feisty old man, considering his life so. And it's funny the way he kept talking about you. He called for you at the end. Oh, why don't you think about coming to visit? We'd all love to see you again.
I'm here at Luxman Ireland House NYU welcoming back somebody who is already no stranger to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, Professor Mick Maloney, someone we're delighted to have on our team and here as part of the music department at NYU, who's in town. Mick, you just finished up a popular and well-frequented concert at Symphony Space, the Celtic Appalachia. How did that go?
Actually, it was grand. They don't mind being called the hillbillies from the mountains of West Virginia, deep down in the holler, you know, the other side of the holler, the real deal. There were the Bing brothers and Jake Crack, and they came up and they were just great. And we had Sheikh Amala Diabaté, a griot from West Africa, playing instruments that would be the precursor to the banjo. Of course, the banjo is originally an African instrument. Kyle Alden from San Francisco with a whole new take on Yeats, setting Yeats' poems to a very, very different kind of musical, putting them in musical settings. And we had a road band, the Greenfields of America, with Athena Turgis and Bill McComiskey and Brendan Dolan and Liz Hanley from NYU here, and just a great time all together. And Jerry O'Sullivan and the Pipes, who of course has taken the master's program here. But a great old rattle, it was grand. And the people came in throngs, and you know, we escaped once more. Fooled them again, as they say.
So once you get over that a little bit, you're planning at the end of the month, we have a treat in store actually at the Irish Arts Centre, physically in the space this time, yourself, Jimmy Keane, Robbie O'Connell are coming together, right?
Oh, we are, and we've been friends for years. We started playing together back in the early 80s. And then we went our different ways. Robbie's the nephew of the Clancy brothers, and they're all gone now, unfortunately. But he joined up with them for nearly 15 years and put his kids through college, his four kids, in the process, which he needed to make a few bob to do. We always stayed in touch. Jimmy Keane is an iron worker from Chicago, son of the late Horace Keane, who was from Connemara, via County Meath, the Gaelic Quechano singer. And we've been playing together on and off for nearly 40 years, but our main time together was in the 80s up to the mid-90s, with about 15 years. And we blazed a kind of a trail out to places like Montana and Idaho, often with Liz Carroll, the great Chicago fiddler, in tow. Washington State, I think of places like Pocatello, Idaho, when it was minus 60 degrees, and I think of Walla Walla, Washington, Missoula, Moscow, Idaho. Not exactly the great centres of urban civilization, shall we say, in the United States, but great places to visit, lovely people. And we were doing the first Irish concerts out there. It was great crack. We made no money, but we had a great time. And, you know, we had a couple of albums in the process.
Those places you're referring to, Mick, are, you know, places that we don't, in today's terms, in terms of urban migration to the centres of New York and Boston, they didn't have that replenishment of migrants, but there's huge Irish communities there.
There would be connections with Ireland, but there would be distant connections. Mm-hmm. If you play Western Nebraska, you'd be maybe looking at somebody who got off the railroads and founded a town like, say, Hyannis, Nebraska. He would have come from Hyannis, Massachusetts, and places like O'Neill, Nebraska, you know, with the vision of one particular Irish immigrant. But those connections are very old, but they do take pride in their Irishness, especially in March, you know, certain times of the year. We would have been playing for a general American folk music audience, and a lot of that would actually have been promoted through radio. In the 80s, public radio was starting to be interested in folk music and in Irish music, and it became kind of a fashionable thing to have an Irish track or two in a weekly radio folk program. And that's really how we got our audience, was through radio and songs that we recorded then, like Kilkelly, which was about written from letters by Peter Jones in Washington. We were the first to record that. Also a song called There Were Roses, written by Tommy Sands, about sectarian conflict and just awful tragedies that were on a very personal level that could people relate to. And of course the usual bag of jigs and reels and hornpipes and so on. And we put together Irish American medleys too. And so we offered a combination of instrumental music and songs, and we were having a ball. As I said, we, at the end of it all, I don't think we made any money at all, but you know, we just having a great time being musicians.
So it's a while since you've played?
It's a while since we've toured. We've played, I'd say, maybe once every 2 years or so. And we've played as part of larger ensembles at festivals and so on. But the three of us together, this is the first time we'll have played New York in 30 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that'd be great. The last time we played here was The Bottom Line, down here in Greenwich Village.
Wow. So that's a treat for people.
Well, it's a treat for us.
Yeah.
We'll hopefully it'll be a treat for people. We're the best of friends, and we, the repertoire we did now, funnily enough, I played through it. We have to relearn a lot of this stuff because we haven't done it in 30 years. But actually, it's still kind of interesting to me. And I'd hate to be part of a group like the rock groups, you know, that reform and try to be the word in the 60s, you know, and do extended tours. We'd never think of doing that. But to get together and celebrate friendship and musicality, that's always great. And we have a blast together.
It's probably unfair to ask it now. I'm probably better off asking you after the concerts, but do you have any sense of how your audiences are Irish Americans? Do you think that there will be a difference in how people will relate to what you're singing? And
I don't know. It remains to be seen. But I know that a lot of people who would have bought our records back in the 80s would be of a certain vintage now. We were the first to book their tickets for our so-called reunion. It really isn't that at all, but it's a good PR tag, isn't it? And I love the fact that we'll be doing it in the intimate setting of the Irish Arts Centre, you know, it's just nice and dark and cosy. And I think we'll have, as I said, we'll have a blast for sure. Hopefully the audience will too. It'll be a little bit of a touch, you know, down memory lane, a bit of the old nostalgia and all of that. Which is, what's it to say, nostalgia is the thing of the future, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So, Mick, they're the 27th and 28th at the Irish Arts Centre.
At the Irish Arts Centre, 8 o'clock each night.
And tickets, people best go online to the Irish Arts Centre.
They should get them sooner rather than later, because I think they're close to selling out. At least the last time I checked, it was looking like that. So it's a small venue, with only 99 seats. So if anybody really wants to come, they should get the ticket, I'd say, sooner rather than later.
And while I have you, is it fair to ask you what else you're going to be doing over the month of March? It's a busy season, probably.
Well, I'm off tomorrow now to San Francisco with Athena Turgis, and we're going to do another version of the Celtic Appalachian Celebration there, which I already started doing back in Philadelphia, and it's a nice theme. to celebrate the connections between Irish music today and Appalachian music, because it's a cultural cousin. And you hear echoes of Irish music in Appalachian music, even though it has gone in its own direction ever since. But they're very natural companions in a concert setting. And we take our cue from the audiences. It's miles of smiles. They love to see the so-called hillbillies. They don't mind being called hillbillies as long as it's not in a pejorative term. But you probably know this, that every Presbyterian immigrant to southern Appalachia in the 1700s was expected to call the eldest son William, or the neighbours would be talking.
Yeah.
The Mountain Williams, the hillbillies.
Yeah.
And at home, the Billy Boys. And here, the hillbillies. This is a disarmingly simple explanation of a term, but it's actually true.
Yeah.
I was touring once with Sammy Sheeler, who's the great bluegrass player. And I said to Sammy, "Where are your people from?" "The north of Ireland." I said, "It's funny." He said, "You know, in the north, it's funny you're not called William." Because he said, "I was the eldest son." I said, "My name is Samuel William Sheeler." I said, "Yeah, you called the second son was Sammy always, William and Sammy." Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's disarmingly simple for a historian. All you need to do is look at the county records.
It's almost so obvious you miss
it. It's so obvious you miss it.
Yeah. And is there a difference, Mick, do you find, in how the West Coast audiences engage with your music and performances?
Well, I don't know, but I would say that if they're fans of the music, that part would be the same. West Coast audiences, traditionally, to me, and when I started touring there first, I realized they're about looking forward more than looking back. Now, I think that's changed. And people are now looking at roots culture in a different way nationally. But you know, the people that emigrated to the West, they weren't looking over the shoulder mm-hmm. as much as people in the East Coast here. So we found we had to adjust our repertoires a little bit, that the historical songs weren't going over to an audience well. But I think that's changed now. So I think the audiences would be about the same. At least that's my sense of it.
Right. Well, thanks, Mick, for coming in. I know it's an incredibly busy time of year for you, and hopefully we'll have you back here sooner rather than later.
Well, I'm delighted that it's a busy time of the year. When I came to America first in 1973, there was one St. Patrick's Day concert. And now it's the whole season for us starts in early March and continues till late April. The Lord give it.
Thank you, Mick.
You're welcome.
My song for you this evening, it's not to make you sad, nor for adding to the sorrows of our troubled northern land. But lately I've been thinking and it just won't leave my mind. I'll tell you of two friends one time who were both good friends of mine. Isaac Scott from Baina, he lived just across the fields. Great man for the music and the dancing and the reels. MacDonald came from South Armagh to Port Young Agnes Fair. And we'd often meet on the Ryan Road and laughter filled the air. There were Protestant and Sean was Catholic born, but it never made a difference for the friendship, it was strong. Sometimes in the evening when we heard the sound of drums, we said it won't divide us, we always will be one. For the ground our fathers plowed in, the soil it is the same, and the places where we say our prayers have just got different names. We talked about the friends who died, we hoped there'd be no more. Little then we realized the tragedy in store. There were on a Sunday morning when another killing had been done just outside Hamlet Town. We knew that Isaac danced up there, we knew he liked the band. When we heard that he was dead, we just could not understand. We gathered at the graveside on a cold and rainy day. The minister, he closed his eyes with no revenge he prayed. And all of us who knew him from along the Ryan Road bowed our heads and we said a prayer for the resting of his soul. There were there was fear in every home. Late this night, a car came prowling around Ryan Road. The Catholic would be killed tonight to even up the score. Oh, Christ, this young MacDonald that they've taken from the door. Isaac was my friend, he cried, he begged them with his tears. Centuries of hatred of ears that cannot hear. An eye for an eye, it was all that filled their minds. And another eye for another eye, till everyone is blind. There were song for you this evening, it's not to make you sad, nor for adding to the sorrows of our troubled northern land. But lately I've been thinking and it just won't leave my mind. I'll tell you of two friends in time who were both good friends of mine. Now I don't know where the moral is, where the song should end, but I wonder just how many wars are fought between the friends. And those who give the orders, they are not the ones to die. It's Scott and MacDonald and the likes of you and I. There were
at Luxman Ireland House NYU, we have had the pleasure of hosting a visiting scholar from the University of Manchester for the past couple of months. Dr. Patrick Doyle, welcome to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour.
Oh, no, thank you. Thanks for having me the last few months.
Oh, it's been our pleasure, and I'm only sad that it's coming towards the end of your tenure with us that I'm having the opportunity to sit down and have a proper chat to you here through the medium of the radio show in particular. I should start off by saying, Patrick, that you are here continuing basically building out from your doctoral research, I suppose. Can you tell us a little bit about your research and perhaps maybe a little bit about your background? We're thinking a lot about Irishness during this month here in New York in the United States and all over the world, of course. But you're coming to us by way of Manchester, as I mentioned, and I suppose someone of Irish descent. It would be very interesting to find out a little bit about your experience as an English person of Irish descent and things like that. So maybe you'd start off by telling us a little bit about your research, because I think that your biography and your research interests kind of come into one. Yeah.
Yes. So my PhD research was on the Irish Cooperative Movement, which was an organisation that was made up of creameries, credit societies that were dotted throughout the Irish countryside. And you're right to say that my biography slices across that, because my grandparents on both sides of my family, as many people were at that time, were members of their local cooperative society, farming background, so they'd be delivering the milk to their creamery every single day. And also being from Manchester, like the cooperative idea, economically, its headquarters globally seem very much as being like based in the northwest of England, and the headquarters now are in Manchester. So I was interested in seeing how those two things went together, cooperation in Ireland and cooperation in Manchester, to see if it maybe spoke to my identity in any kind of way. In fact, it's all very, very messy and confusing, but I guess that's kind of par for the course when you try to work out what it is our Irishness is, or particularly for me anyway. So I was very much interested in terms of the actual historical research I was carrying out and how those co-ops, which emerged in the 1890s and were really growing throughout the 1900s, 1910s, 1920s, a very kind of particularly interesting political moment for Ireland, or political few decades rather than a moment, should I say, and looking at how they were feeding into some of these much, you know, these much bigger kind of like political moments. But the thing about the co-op is they were kind of embedded there on a day-to-day basis. So the change that they were exerting on the countryside, even though it was very, very radical, it was very gradual as well at the same time. So I was really interested in kind of mapping their development over kind of a 30, 40 year period. And then my argument became about looking at how they were feeding into the political and economic ideas that came to form part of the bedrock of the Irish state, especially after the 1920s. So that was really what my PhD focuses on, very much the movement within Ireland.
I think, Patrick, some of our listeners will be very familiar with, you know, the notion of the co-op and the creamery. It definitely became, and to some extent even today, is still embedded in the rural landscape and the community, the frame of reference for a community. Can you tell us a little bit about, is the Irish cooperative movement something that originated in the British equivalent? Is that how it came to us?
Again, it's more complicated than that, but in some respects it is. Obviously, when you have a neighbour that's so prominent within forming cooperation, that's going to have some impact. But actually, the Irish really took more of their influence from the Danes and the Germans. The reason being that the British model was focused around shops, and it was about getting the best price for a working class industrial membership base. So they needed to get goods as cheaply as possible so they could pass the savings on to their customers. In Ireland, the cooperative movement was more about getting the best prices possible for the producers, the farmers. So they wanted as high a price as possible at the other end of the network. And that led to a conflict between the two movements, and also a big clash between the Irish and British cooperative movements. But really it was the Danes, because at the same time, Irish butter was losing out to the Danish butter market and the Danish butter producers and also the pig farmers. So one of the reasons for that was Danish farmers had become more efficient through the method of cooperation. And people such as Horace Plunkett, who I was talking about in the lecture, who was the leader of the co-op movement, thought it would probably be a good idea to take some of the good things that Denmark were doing and try them out in Ireland. So a mix of Britain, but also there's things going on in the continent as well that were feeding into Ireland.
And what was going on in terms of cooperative movements in the United States at the time, if anything?
Well, I mean, co-ops, they have quite a messy history, and I think one of the reasons that they're kind of overlooked, particularly within certain strands of labour history, they're seen as very much kind of feeding into, coming out of a working class movements, working class history. But they're very hard to define, because sometimes they do very, very different things. So there were co-ops in the United States, but they weren't kind of a big overall cohesive movement, so different things would be happening in different parts of the country. The ones I know most about are the ones that I was studying through the vigour of Horace Plunkett. So really I'm talking about the co-ops in America, in places such as Wisconsin, Chicago, the Midwest, parts of upstate New York as well, places where there was kind of large rural areas. So
that probably in some way, Patrick, speaks to the just sheer expanse of the United States as well, in terms of, you know, just the unwieldiness of an all-embracing cooperative organisation, perhaps.
Oh, definitely. So when I was looking at the rise of the cooperative movement in Wisconsin, one of the happy coincidences that Charles McCarthy, who was the man there who's involved in kind of leading the movement, he was happy to notice several years later that something similar had been happening in California. There, I think the man was called Aaron Shapiro. So he was helping organize farmers, in particular wine growers, down in California. And then there were kind of connections then that would be made between the two, but those two had grown up spontaneously apart. But Wisconsin, through the research I was carrying out this time, did take its own lead then from the Irish model and very much kind of generated their own sort of cooperative principles, also from the German and the Danish models, but through the figure of Plunkett they were able to insert a lot of the Irish ideas as well.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Plunkett because I've had the opportunity to hear you speak about him in particular, and it's fascinating. But just to jump back a little bit to your own biography, Patrick, do you remember, I mean, were you a young child going to Ireland and saw grandparents involved in cooperative movements, or how exactly did this come about? Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about your academic journey in terms of where the seed of interest came about for this project.
Yep, certainly. As you say, I grew up in Manchester, but each school holiday we spent back in Ireland. My grandparents, particularly my mother's parents, were still alive. My grandfather was still alive, my dad's side, when I was young. He died when I was quite young. In particular, I had very strong memories of my mother's father, who died at the age of 98, and he was farming till he was 90. And I do vaguely remember him having to sell his last couple of cows and, of course, give up his final shares in the co-op. So these things came back to me years later, but turns out they were there embedded, sort of, and maybe some buried away in the subconscious.
And where did he live, Patrick?
So he was my mother's people from just outside, well, they're in South Sligo, I guess halfway between Tubbercurry and Charlestown and Mayo would be where they're from, a place called the Dorforth, near Tullystran. And he actually then emigrated to live with us in Manchester when he was 90, so he left home quite late on, I guess, and lived in Manchester till he was 98. So I guess as well, having him as always growing up in the house in Manchester, it's kind of, there's quite a strong rural Irish presence there all the time as well, so that definitely had a huge kind of influence on me.
So you were born in the 80s or 70s, Patrick?
85.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about growing up the son of Irish parents in Manchester in the 80s and 90s then.
Well, I guess the 80s are a bit hazy, but certainly I can pick it up in the 90s. My dad was from Kerry, so he was mad into the GAA, and I'm afraid I was probably a bit of a disappointment in that respect. I wasn't very too sporty, still am, but I did get into the music, you know, the Colthus, the traditional Irish music in Manchester was a particularly strong scene in the 90s, so we kind of got sucked into that, and we had that aspect of Irishness as well going on in our lives. We would be playing in sessions, round the fires, taking part in the Manchester St. Patrick's Day Parade. All that kind of stuff was very prominent in our kind of social lives in Manchester throughout the 90s and the early 2000s. Even in Manchester, we had a very kind of strong Irish context for growing up.
So how did that translate, for example, when you went to school? Were you going to school with kids who were of similar backgrounds, or were you going to a place where it was more mixed, and how did Irishness fit into that tapestry?
Well, South Manchester, where I'm from, has a very kind of strong second, third generation Irish presence. It's actually my first place I lived in Manchester's Levenshulme, which, if anyone knows, Manchester is sometimes referred to as County Levenshulme. Mm. So a lot of Irish bars, businesses, Irish people, things like the butchers were selling chef sauce. All these kind of, you know, Irish food goods are also very prominent and easy to get hold of. So, yeah, it was a very, very Irish, but also had its own very kind of Mancunian dynamic as well. I'm from Burnage, which is also where Oasis are from, and I'm sure a lot of people have heard of them. And even the Gallagher brothers themselves, they have a very kind of, they never kind of shied away from their Irishness, but I guess it also had a kind of its own particular dynamic, maybe very particular to those two, actually, as opposed to everyone in Manchester. But these things, you know, they were very prominent. Irishness was a very kind of a big part of South Manchester. And then when I went to secondary school, I went to a Christian Brothers school, so that was actually less Irish. I think there was an attempt to kind of develop a sort of English Catholicism there. We were schooled in sports such as rugby, and it was a very kind of bizarre mix of Christian Brothers trying to inculcate a kind of English public school ethos. So Irishness was less prominent in my secondary school, but as I say, we'd come home in the evening, I'd be pulling out my accordion or whatever, so it'd be...
And presumably, given that it was Christian Brothers, a lot of the kids were probably of Irish descent attending, right?
There were a good few, but the secondary school I went to was a bit further away, but there was a lot of people of Polish descent, Italian, French descent, a lot of Irish descent as well.
Mixed.
Yeah, it was less prominent there.
So, say, over the last 10 years or so, being Irish in Britain, in England in particular, probably became kind of, you know, cool, trendy, sexy or whatever. And that wasn't always the case. Probably for most of your adulthood, it's been kind of cool to be Irish in Britain, but there's a strong narrative of the Irish not feeling welcome. Did you ever have any experience, or is that something that you are familiar with?
I do recall, yeah, the birth of Irish cool. I guess it happened, you know, with the River Dance and the Corrs, and these were, like, very, very prominent. Also, I remember, you know, when I was 11 years old as well, the bomb that went off in Manchester as well also crossed that too, so it was a very... Maybe it was a confusing time as well to be Irish at this height, where there was kind of a big pop culture presence, but then also something significant politically had happened. But I must admit, at that time, either I didn't notice it or it just kind of went over my head. I was too young. Even after 1996, I never really encountered any kind of bad feeling towards Irish amongst people I knew. That said, there were one or two instances that were reported in the press about, you know, maybe Irish bars being targeted in the immediate aftermath. But very, very quickly, I think people in Manchester just carried on. But as I say, I was 11, so I think if it was going on, it probably passed by me a little bit.
So being here, this is your first time in the United States, is it, Patrick?
No, it's not my first time. I was here 5 years ago. I was actually over here twice. There was once we were out in San Francisco, had some family out there, so we had a bit of a family reunion. And then I had just finished a job I'd been working at just before my PhD. And me and a couple of friends decided to go backpacking, so we did a couple of months across the United States with our rucksack.
For some reason, I thought it was your first time. Okay, so over the last few months since you've been here and building out on your research on the Irish cooperative movement and particularly, I suppose, on Horace Plunkett, I suppose you've had the opportunity to see Irishness play out in a different context, in New York in particular. Are there any observations or comparisons or differences that spring to mind when you compare Irish identity in the United States, or at least in New York, with Manchester or England more generally?
I think so. And I mean, I can only really speak for myself in these kind of observations, and people will probably disagree with me, and that's fine. But one thing I did find, which was quite refreshing, is maybe people seem more at ease with that kind of hybrid nature about being Irish-American. Because I was talking to someone about this the other day, the idea that you can't really describe yourself as Anglo-Irish, because that obviously has a kind of particular sort of historical connotation. So then it leads, what do these people get called? I mean, these people, people such as I, how do we define ourselves? Which isn't as easy as one might think. The label I settled upon for myself is a kind of Hiberno-Mancunian, which, again, it probably isn't too satisfactory, but it kind of gives a sense to, I probably associate more with this sort of a Manchester identity as opposed to an Englishness or Britishness mixed in with that Irishness. That seems to make more sense for me. And now maybe people are riddled with that kind of anxiety in the United States as well, but I must admit I didn't notice it as much. People are much more comfortable describing themselves as Irish-American. And actually, when I was out here a few years ago, I did have a grandaunt. She lived up in Yonkers. She's dead now, God rest her, but she was very much, she'd come from Kerry as a young lady. And I remember her telling me she was surprised I had an Irish passport. She couldn't believe that I didn't go for a British passport. And she was very proud to tell me that the day she was able to trade in her Irish passport for an American passport, that's when she felt very much more at ease, and she wasn't going to give up that American passport for anything. And she'd been born in Ireland, so I found that quite interesting. The kind of the embrace of an American identity was much less maybe troubling than maybe the embrace of a kind of a British identity. There's probably very specific historical reasons for that.
But. Yeah, yeah, and also specific historical reasons, I think, Patrick, and also in my observations, and, you know, this is pretty much limited to the Irish case, although I've done, you know, a little bit of comparative work in looking at other groups as well. But there's a particular way in which English or British or English, whichever one you want to use in a way, how people are kind of taken into British or English culture that is different. I suppose what I'm trying to get at, what I argue myself in some of my own research, is comparing the United States with Britain are like polar opposites. They're actually not representative at all, because the United States is one extreme, and you can see that in not just the Irish case and most other ethnic groups to some extent, and Britain is the other end of the spectrum. I think that's part of the reason I feel quite strongly that comparative work in terms of the Irish experience is so important, you know. So back to someone who was thinking comparatively and crossing that Atlantic in an interesting way, Horace Plunkett, who is a key figure in the Irish cooperative movement and is the person you were mainly here researching for the last few months, right? And his connections with people here?
That's correct. I mean, Horace Plunkett himself, for people who don't know, he was an Anglo-Irish gentleman and a social reformer. And as I said earlier on, he founded the cooperative movement. But he very much split his time between the United States and Ireland. He'd lived out in the United States as a young man. He had suspected TB, so he'd moved to Wyoming and became very successful there in cattle ranching. So he always had one foot in both countries, and his life was really, each year was defined by his winters in the United States, and then he'd return back to Ireland more often than not, maybe February, March time. But his business interests, they overlapped in the two countries. So his promotion of the cooperative movement in Ireland actually had a fundraising aspect in the United States, which is something also that things like the Irish Parliamentary Party and Sinn Féin and other kind of organisations were also quite adept at. So Plunkett was part of that, but he actually became much more involved and embedded within a network of social scientists, economists, politicians, some very, very influential ones such as Teddy Roosevelt. He was also fairly close, but not as close as he was to Roosevelt, with Woodrow Wilson, but particularly close to some of Wilson's advisors. So he always had a foot in the door of the White House for that, for the early 20th century anyway. So he managed to gradually build up a very kind of impressive portfolio of contacts, and he used them. He was very proactive in pushing forward an idea he may have about how what he called the rural problem could be resolved. And as I say, there was a big focus on that in Ireland, because Ireland was not totally, but there was a large part of the country that was agricultural and rural. So his ideas had been applied there, but he saw what he was doing in Ireland as actually part of something that needed to be done on a worldwide basis. This idea that there was a gap emerging between the countryside and the city, and it needed to be addressed. Otherwise, civilization, as he thought, was kind of becoming too imbalanced and was in danger of kind of falling apart. So he believed that there had to be a lot of attention and a lot of modernising work carried out in the countryside.
I'm going to share with our listeners at some point soon the recording of a fascinating lecture you gave on Horace Plunkett and his connections in particular to people like William Burke Cochrane and Charles McCarthy, who you mentioned earlier as well. But for those of our listeners who aren't familiar, and indeed for myself, at this point you must have gotten inside the head a little bit of Horace Plunkett. I mean, what are the biographical markers in his background, or can you give us a sense of what made him tick? What was the inspiration for him getting into all this in the first place?
Well, how he actually got interested in co-ops, and it's very early on he does this, is very, very hard to pinpoint, but certainly he was experimenting on cattle whilst a young man in his 20s in the United States. He did visit Manchester in 1889, which is when he returns to Ireland, and is involved in establishing the first co-op creamery in Drumcollagh in County Limerick. So that occurs shortly after a visit to Manchester, and he didn't really detail what occurred in that visit, but I think it's probably safe to assume he was talking to people in cooperative circles, and then very soon after he's involved, as I say, in establishing the first co-op. But in terms of key milestones politically and economically, in 1894 then he founds the Irish Agricultural Organisation Society, which is a body that is devoted to directing the coordination of all these individual co-ops and making sure that they're all kind of developing in how he'd call the correct way. Plunkett was also an MP. He was an MP from 1892 to 1900 in South Dublin. He was nominally a unionist, although he was disliked equally by the Irish Parliamentary Party, in particular John Dillon, but was also hated by his unionist party. He was seen as too conciliatory, perhaps, on the university question. He was friends with people like Michael Cusack, Douglas Hyde.
That's what I was going to actually ask you, Patrick. I mean, because when this is all happening, you know, it's such an important time in terms of the Gaelic Athletic Association. Yeah. You've just mentioned Cusack and the Gaelic Revival and all this stuff that's going on. So he's a Protestant he's grown up with a silver spoon in his mouth, right? How does he locate himself then in terms of his relationships or friendships or political connections with all these other things going on?
He sees the Irish question as one predominantly about social conditions and economics. He thinks nationalists and unionists are missing the point in being so obsessed with resolving Ireland's constitutional status within the UK. His big thing was Ireland should sort itself out materially, that is, provide decent living conditions and try and prevent things such as emigration before it started sorting out the kind of the big political questions. So that met with a lot of opposition, and he therefore saw himself as outside the political mainstream, which would actually allow him, so he believed, to intervene as a kind of independent moderate voice of opinion. But the problem was, because he was so unpopular, that didn't always quite work the way he expected. But he did devote his life to the social and economic problems, and that for him was the priority, as opposed to whether Home Rule should come about. Now, as it happened, as he grew older, he became increasingly supportive of Home Rule, and he was actually involved in 1917 and 1918. He chaired something called the Irish Convention, which was an attempt to rescue Home Rule after 1916, but more importantly, from his point of view, he wanted to avoid partition of Ireland.
Do you have a sense, Patrick, do the sources allow you to discern how he felt about 1916? Just because we're thinking about it a lot at the moment.
Of course. He was... So he wouldn't have been in favour of the rebellion itself. He was taken by surprise. I think he was in the United States at the time, because the United States wasn't a part of the Allied movement in the early years of the First World War. And he saw his role actually to act as a kind of intermediary between the British and the Americans in order to try and maintain a good feeling between those two people. So he saw 1916. He was a bit concerned because he was afraid that that might, first of all, create a breakdown in the relations between Britain and the potential allies of the Americans. But he was also distressed to see the rebellion happen in Dublin. He wasn't supportive of the execution of the leaders. But also in 1916, he also, around that time, actually had an X-ray in London and got very, very badly burned. So it was at the same time he experiences a massive downturn in his health. So he actually disappears from the public scene for a good few months of that year because he has to take to his bed. He was badly burned by, as I say, the X-ray, but it led to a lot of operations, and he was plagued by ill health for the rest of his life, yet maintained his to and fro in between Ireland and the United States. So actually 1916 is a bad year for Plunkett for many reasons, but he also, as I say, takes a back seat for a few months, so he doesn't really make too many public statements about 1916 and the Easter Rising itself. But you do get a sense from his diaries that he's distressed in general about the whole thing.
So what's next in terms of the project, Patrick? Are you content with the amount of research you got done here in the United States?
Yes. So, I mean, in terms of what's next, I'm converting my PhD into manuscripts. So that's really looking at the co-op movement within the national borders, shall we say. And then I hope to get an article out now based on the research I've done in the United States and looking at very much that transatlantic relationship through the figure of Plunkett. But ideally, the way I'd like to go is really try and write this kind of transnational history of rural cooperation, of which, of course, Ireland is a huge seam of research and a huge thread, because it's not just Plunkett, but Plunkett is the one I follow this time, but there are different Irish cooperative experts, and indeed cooperative experts from different countries, who are interacting in a very intense way, but a way that kind of usually slips through the seams of governmental history, because co-ops kind of stand outside the official circuits of power, should we say. So these people are quite disparate and hard to pin down, but once you kind of start piecing them all together, you see actually that they do exist in this kind of very, very large intellectual and proactive network. But you just try to piece all these pieces of the puzzle together. But that's ultimately the way I'd like to go.
Well, it sounds fascinating, Patrick. Hopefully when you have more threads of that puzzle pulled together, we'll have another opportunity to have a chat to you. Best of luck with the project, and thanks for coming to join us here on the Luxembourg Ireland House NYU Radio Hour.
Okay, no, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure, so thanks for having me. It's been great.
Farewell to the groves of Shillelagh and Shamrock. Farewell to the girls of old Ireland all around. May their hearts be as merry as ever you could find them, as far away o'er the ocean I am bound. For me mother is old and me father quite feeble, to leave their own country, it grieves their heart full sore. Oh, the tears down their cheeks, in great drops they are rolling, to think they must die upon a foreign shore. So it's pack up your sea stores, consider no longer, for $10 a week is not very bad pay, with no taxes nor ties to devour up your wages when you're on the green fields of America.
for half an hour across the broad Atlantic. My friends are standing on the pier in grief and sorrow frantic. My trunks are all stowed down below the good ship San O'Leary. The anchor's weighed, the gangway's up, I'm leaving Tipperary. So it's goodbye Mick and it's goodbye Pat, and it's goodbye Kate and Mary. The anchor's weighed, the gangway's up, I'm leaving Tipperary. See, there's the steamer blazing up, I can no longer stay. We're bound for New York City, boy, 3,000 miles away. My portmanteau with the dog packed with potatoes, greens and bacon. If you don't think I look after that, it's rude, you are mistaken. I'm deep in love with Molly Burke as a jackass is in clover. When I get set, if she will come, I'll pay her passage over. So it's goodbye Mick and it's goodbye Pat and it's goodbye Kate and Mary. The anchor's way, the gangway's up, I'm leaving Tipperary. See, there's a steamer blazing up, I can no longer stay. But I'm bound for New York City, boy, 3,000 miles away.
I'm a decent boy just landed from the town of Ballyfad. Oh, I want a situation and I want it mighty bad. A position I saw advertised, 'tis the thing for me, says I. With a dirty spalpeen ended with no Irish need apply. Oh, says I, but that's an insult, but to get this place I'll try. So I went to see the blackguard with no Irish need apply. Well, some may think it's a misfortune to be christened Pastor Dan, but to me it is an honor to be born an Irish man.
We are coming towards the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and at irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour or to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flannelly Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Slán agus beannacht.